When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode number 29.
Altitude.
Tower at Meyer Space has released you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Sea tide, Altitude 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector,
I'm speaking to my friend today.
My friend Rav Gurpal's at 354.
Viper 01, be advised, the restricted area 6002 is still active.
Sir, yeah, lights on.
Doctor, picture 16,000.
Viper 1 targeted.
A slingshot, because it looked like a slingshot. And here's what haunts me, Rain. It haunts me to this day because nobody knew what the hell was going on. ABCCC, everybody's quiet. And I remember looking over the canopy rail and seeing kaboom. And then shortly thereafter, another explosion. I'm saying, man, the Navy's hammering the beach down there. Well, it wasn't the Navy. I saw three helicopters get shot down in about 5 minutes. Killed a bunch of Marines. So now all hell's breaking loose. Are the survivors of the Mayaguez, are the crew members on that island? Now, we worked with some of the PJs, and there were some jolly greens involved in this thing. And, you know, they'd be keying their mic. They're running for their lives and saying, Sandy, Sandy, we're taking fire. We're taking fire. You could hear the bullets or the guns and everything else. And I mean, what the hell do you do?
Hey, thanks for listening. That's the voice of my guest today, Slough. And he's talking about the Mayaguez incident, which is dating back to the Vietnam days. We're going to discuss that as well as many other things. He's flown quite a few planes and seen a few things. But before we get into the episode with Slough, if you're enjoying the podcast, again, swing it over to iTunes, taking the 5 seconds to hit the 5-star review button and leave a review. It can be just a couple words. That helps the podcast out. And for all those who have done it, thank you. And if you're just bored and haven't done it, swing over to iTunes. Hit that. Make it happen. I took the week off last week. I was down at Sun and Fun. Quite a good time. And we're getting back into it. So I owe you guys a Q&A session. But if you're looking for more content, you can swing over to patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast. Each tier has an associated merchandise level. All that stuff is going out here in the next week. For all those who have signed up, thank you for supporting the podcast. Thank you for helping it grow. I appreciate that. And again, stories like There I Was, just some bonus content lives up there, as well as some behind the scenes, ad-free episodes, and a few other things. Again, you can find that at patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast. And as I always say, for me, it's challenging to spell that, but something really simple is theafterburnpodcast.com. And you can find all of this and much more, to include videos, more behind the scenes content, if you swing over there. So with that being said, let's get into the episode with Slough.
Awesome. Slough, thank you for joining me on the podcast. We've jumped a few hurdles to make this happen. People don't see the scheduling that's behind the scenes, but I appreciate you taking the time to be here. Before we get rolling, we give everyone the standard elevator pitch of who you are, where you've been, and what you're doing today. It's going to be tough for you to surmise in 60 seconds as I look at your resume, but Take as much time as you want.
Well, Rain, I tell you, I really appreciate it. Everybody likes to talk about themselves, you know, especially fighter pilots.
No joke.
I will try to hit the highlights. You know, looking back on my career, I'm 73 years old, and You know, sometimes I amaze myself. First of all, shocked to be alive this long. But, okay, I grew up in Kansas. My dad was a cowboy. He was a tough-as-nails guy, but a very soft heart. And I graduated from a very small graduating class of 19 in Southeast Kansas. I went to Wichita State. My uncle worked at Boeing, and he kind of headed me in the Air Force ROTC because at that time they had draft numbers. And I had a pretty high one or low one, however way you look at it.
Yeah.
So I got into Air Force ROTC and barely made it through the first 2 years because of my setting my hair on fire and raising hell and drinking and everything else. But I got serious about ROTC. Thanks a lot for my buddy Lou for getting me through there. And from Wichita State, I went to Shepherd Air Force Base, and I trained with the Germans.
Okay.
Now, later on, they had the Euro-NATO Joint Jet Pilot Training. I don't even know whether they still have that or not, but we probably had 75% German IPs and about half the class, maybe a few more Americans, and all the Germans were going to F-104s. So from there, I was lucky enough to get the A-7D, which was a relatively new airplane for the Air Force. The Navy had it A-7E, so I got the A-7D to Myrtle Beach, and it was grounded for a while with engine problems, so I flew the T-33, which your older viewers are going to say. It was a great airplane. I loved it. I got about 100 hours in it. Easy to fly, hard to taxi. And from there, I came back to, went to Davis-Monthan and for 6 months, got checked out in the A-7, and we talked a little bit about that, and then went back to Myrtle Beach, was there only a few months, and we got deployed to Southeast Asia at Karat Air Force Base in Thailand, which had a tremendous amount of history with F-105s, and I was over there, let's see, 7 months, came back to Myrtle Beach for a year. And then went back to Karat in a different squadron. We took over the search and rescue role from the A1E. So I flew the A7D for search and rescue, which we talk about that because it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I'd love to.
And was involved in the Maiguez incident over there, and we stayed for a year. And then I came back to Holloman and flew the T-38B, we called it then. And we talk about that because, you know, I was bummed out. I said, holy moly, I got this combat time. I'm going back to flight T-38s. You know what, Rain? It turned out to be probably the highlight of my career. I've got such good memories. And from there, I was lucky enough to go to F-5 weapons school at Willie for about 6 months, and I flew the F-5 up there with the Allies. We had Iranians in there and Kuwaitis and South Koreans, and it was thoroughly enjoyable, even though it was a lot of hard work. So then I come back to Holloman because I picked up a training commitment, and lo and behold, I didn't even remember I'd put in for an Astra tour. Now, you guys, you young guys probably don't even know what the hell an Astra tour is, but it
you gotta,
is.
You got to tell me.
It stands for Air Staff Training. Now, you have to understand, I was a much motivated career officer. So I was kind of punching the right tickets and all this other stuff. But I got an Astra tour and I went to the Pentagon for a little over a year, maybe between a year, year and a half, which was a great experience. Now, guys would say, I met the mythical, the great mythical bird called the real Air Force. I said, oh, boy, oh, boy. You know, always in the back of my mind, I wanted to be an airline pilot. God knows I didn't tell any of my fighter pilots. They'd throw you out of the unit, you know. Yeah. But so I was up there about a year and a half. We'll talk about that. I run into some great Patriots, learned a hell of a lot and everything else. Now, that would have been about 79-80. So then I lucked out and got back to go back to Holloman to fly T-38s because I had a year left on my commitment. And I couldn't get out of it. And so then I did that and I got an airline job with a startup airline out of Newark, New Jersey, of all places. I was a first officer for 3 weeks. What luck. Blind ass luck. 32 years as a captain. And now I had a year off. I took a year off. But, you know, I wanted, for selfish reasons, to get my retirement in. So I got a job at the Boys from Syracuse, we called it, was the nickname of the squadron. And they were flying A-10s, a relatively new airplane at the time. So I joined those guys in 82. And I flew the A-10 for about 7.5 years and finished up with the F-16. And I flew the F-16A model and the F-16C GE engine, which I think you like a little better.
There we go. Pratt. Yeah, yeah. That's what you, that's a Pratt.
And I flew the Big Mouth Block 30, I think, at the time, which was a rocket. That thing was a rocket. So I retired in 96. I had 25 years in and then continued with the airlines. And I retired with the airlines in 2013.
Quite a career.
You know, I look back on it, there is a hell of a lot of randomness and luck. But, you know, as we go along here, maybe I can throw in some pearls of wisdom, but that's not guaranteed.
Well, but, you know,
that was my career. I was very fortunate. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, better be lucky than good, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, backing all the way up. So the A7, is that the plane you wanted out of pilot training, or did you want to go do something else?
Absolutely. That was the plane. You know, it was very popular for young guys going in because they hadn't taken any lieutenants in. They hadn't taken anybody out of pilot training. And it was new, virtually brand new. And everybody was fired up about it. Now, in our class, we did pretty good because a lot of academy guys went to Shepherd. And if you wanted to fly a fighter, they seemed to get more fighters down. So we only had American-wise, I'm just kind of guessing, probably 18 to 20 guys graduate. And there were two F-4s, one RF-4, and an A-7. So I got the A-7. So yeah, to answer that question, absolutely, I wanted to fly it. And, you know, it was such a kind of a hot button item because we had a few fighter pilots as instructors in UPT, and I'll never forget this as long as I live. I wish the hell I could see him now. In one of the parties after graduation, you know, I was going to the A7. He come up. He was, I think, pretty sure he's an old F-100 driver, which kind of surprised me. He said, we should not be putting lieutenants in goddamn single seat fighters. It's dangerous. And he said, you'll be dead in 6 months, and walked away. And now I'm saying, holy moly, baby, he's right.
Awesome. Let's go do this. You know, and
but I lived through it.
Well, you know, that mentality, it's changed.
I'm sure it has.
Somewhat still there. When the Raptor came online, I mean, up until 2013, 2014, I think we were still sending Raptor lieutenants. Those lieutenants go into the Raptor. They had to go out to Luke, and they had to do like 3 or 4 rides in the back or in the F-16 with an instructor in the back seat. So they get crash course in the F-16, and I think it was day refueling, night refueling, and they wanted to make sure they could land a plane by themselves. Now that's gone, and it'll go away because F-35, there are new two-seat variants. And there's only so many two-seat variants of the F-16. So interesting. I'm sure that was just, let's go get this once you got those words.
Well, it was great because I'm kind of guessing here with a shaky memory, but how many did we have? Maybe 8 to 10 guys, maybe not, right around 10 guys. Everyone was a lieutenant. And we went to DM in the 333rd Squadron. And we had such great instructors, mostly F-100 guys, a few 105 guys. And it was a great experience, I'll tell you. And, you know, that first ride, no two-seaters. I mean, I was scared to death,
yeah. I'm telling
you. And a guy chasing me, hell, he didn't say anything.
Be a champion.
So, but hey, you talk about your confidence level soaring, you know, I mean, it's always a feather in your cap. It's an ego thing, you know, single seat, single engine. So,
yeah,
but I hear you. It kind of goes away. It's a kind of the culture that changed a little bit, I'm sure.
What was his driving factor for saying you'll live 6 months? Was it purely the fact that, you know, there were not that many single seats, or they weren't sending lieutenants to single seats, or was it the Vietnam War? What drove, you think, his mentality saying you're not going to live past 6 months?
You know, I don't know. I have no idea what the hell he was thinking. Possibly a little envy. Because, you know, those guys weren't too crazy about being a T-38 instructor.
Right.
And, you know, the culture there was they put a hell of a lot of guys in the pilots in the back seat of the F-4 as young guys, which they hated. And it didn't really serve any purpose. So, boy, I tell you, Rain, I don't know why, because all those guys, all my instructors that I remember at DM were top-notch guys. I mean, they didn't even think about it.
Right.
You know, they said, you know, you're going to do this, you're going to get through with it, you know. So, hey, we didn't hurt anybody. Like the Germans I went through, they went to Luke, you know, in the F-104, and amongst other planes, they called it the Widowmaker. They used to kill one a class out there.
Yeah.
Because that's a tough airplane.
Yeah. Unforgiving.
Yeah, very unforgiving. So that was the reason, I guess. But it was thoroughly enjoyable. So I go back to Myrtle Beach and there for a short time, and we headed off to Karat. So we can talk about that, whatever you want to do.
Yeah, so I would like to talk about Karat. So two tours in Karat. The first, right. So the lead up to going downrange, what was that like? Did you get a lot of training, or what was the mission focus? Or was it pretty much show up and ride out the door?
Well, if I understand that question correctly, you know, obviously, probably the way it is now, you're not mission ready until you get back to your unit, and then you got to take some rides.
Yep.
And I can't really remember, but, you know, I would think we got back there at the end of the year, and we left to go to Thailand, the squadron did, in about May, I think, April or May. So we didn't have a lot of time.
Yeah, so, for the listeners, I guess what I was trying to get at, to be a fighter pilot, and, you know, today's, you go through the F-16 training, the F-22 training, the schoolhouse, and you come out qualified to fly the plane, and there are some exceptions, right, and some of the pipelines are different. But for the F-16 pipeline specifically, you're not a combat mission ready wingman until you show up to your squadron, and then you go through about a 3 to 6 month spin up focusing on that primary mission set of that unit, because they vary. So did you come out of Tucson fully mission ready and qualified, and you're basically just getting some reps before you went to Karat, or did you have to get mission ready at Myrtle Beach?
I think I had to get mission ready at Myrtle Beach. Obviously a wingman. I mean, you're just hanging on as number two to get the experience. But yeah, and then obviously I was mission combat ready when I left there. And one of the things I thought was interesting, you know, we'd have certain classifications for instruments where the certain weather minimums and everything else. We get to Karat, you didn't have weather minimums out, nothing. I mean, you're going, man, you're on a combat mission. Yeah. So, I don't think that's changed very much, to tell you the truth. You know, you get your mission ready. Once you're mission ready, then, you know, you go up to two ship flight lead, and then a 4 ship flight lead and all that. But I was certainly a green wingman that first combat mission I flew. I'm hanging on the wing.
What were those missions like?
They weren't too bad looking back on it. You know, we didn't have any real big threat there. We only flew in Cambodia. I mean, the POWs had been released in 73, and I had 63 missions in Cambodia, mostly, you know, to use the vernacular, tree busters, not too much. But some of the later ones were pretty good. Now, we worked close air support, obviously, and mostly with OV-10s out of NKP. And some of them were pretty good. I remember working a few TICs, and for your audience, that's troops in contact, where you're pretty damn close. And now, as a little bit of bias on my part, the FACS loved us because the A-7D was one of the first airplanes for computed bombing. And it had a super sophisticated system at that time where you could drop dumb bombs. And then, you know, if you had a good system, it would nail it. So, plus we had a lot of loiter time. So the F-4 guys, they weren't too happy with the FACS. Says, oh, we got some A-7s in here. Oh, boy. Okay. F-4s, you hold for a while. So because we dropped pinpoint bombs, you know, so that's certainly what they liked. But they weren't really that exciting, you know. The only story that it's kind of funny, you know, I was more concerned about engine failures. There at one time, all the A7s were grounded in the States, but we were still flying.
Yeah, that's
because, you know, we're flying combat sorties. That yeah. It was an Allison engine. I said, holy moly, what the hell? So my big plan was, if you look at a map, you can see Tonle Sap Lake. It's kind of in the middle south portion of Cambodia. So I said, well, geez, if I lose an engine here, I'm going to jump out in Tonle Sap Lake and they'll pick me up. Well, we had an intel briefing not too long after that. And they say, stay the hell away from Tonle Sap Lake. It's filled with crocodiles. So I'm going, oh my God. I have nightmares about coming down my parachute. There's a crocodile waiting on me.
I always joked about the poopy suit and having to wear that. So, you know, Sumter, South Carolina, not too far away from Myrtle Beach. You know, it can be 80 degrees surface temperature, nice and hot on the flight line. And then the water temperature is below 60 where you're going to go fight. So you'd wear that poopy suit and you're sweating and miserable. And I always joked, like, I'm going to be the guy who, like, doesn't zip his suit up enough. I have to punch out and I'm going to go in the water and it's going to fill. So I've been hot and miserable through ground ops, flying. I'm uncomfortable. I punch out and now my suit fills with cold water and I die of hypothermia and I'm just angry at the world. It'd be like punching out in that lake with a bunch of crocodiles, like survive the ejection and then get eaten by a crocodile. Not where you want to be in life.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I was very lucky. Mentioned that poopy suit, Rain. I never had to wear one.
Oh,
I should have one time, but I.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Cheated and didn't.
Well, it's funny to see the different units, you know, Shaw being an active duty base and there's unnamed guard base nearby. The guard base would be wearing the poopy suits. We're high-fiving in and out of the airspace. And, you know, their leadership said, hey, it's up to you. Like, the onus is on you. If you want to wear it, you should wear it. Versus active duty, you know, it's everyone's going to wear it. Everyone's going to be miserable. I mean, if you go into the water 60 degrees or colder, that's not going to be a fun time. You just better hope the Coast Guard shows up pretty quick, I think.
Oh, no question. Yeah. No question.
I always joked, I wouldn't survive Arctic. I would fail Arctic survival because I would die. Being a Georgia boy, like, I just don't do cold. So
I understand.
So those missions, so troops in contact, that time it's kind of like winding down. It's got to be kind of a weird environment on the trail end of the Vietnam War, I would imagine. Was it not?
It was. It certainly was. You know, and another thing, I was I didn't think about too much, but all the POWs were at home. They let them go in, I think it was April 73. So, you know, if you got shot down over there, I mean, what the hell is going to happen to you? You know, you're not going to the Hilton. So, but it was peculiar, but still, you know, you're getting ground fire, maybe 37 millimeters, the biggest they had. I'll never forget my first mission over there working with a FAC. And I roll in about my second pass. He says, hey, two, you better start moving that airplane around, buddy. They're shooting at you. I said, oh, yeah. But yeah, no big threat. You know, we did some AC-130 escorts too at night. And I'm sure you've heard guys say this before. It's amazing what you can see at night. Yikes, there's a lot of lead coming at you don't see during the daytime.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Were you guys flying on goggles or all naked eye?
No, that was so far ahead of night vision goggles that, in fact, I never had to wear any of those either.
Your so eyesight's whatever. Good. Yeah, you're golden.
Oh boy! Very, very lucky. So yeah, that was way before that, but it was exciting. I wanted to do it in the worst way to get over there because I thought I was going to entirely miss out on the war, you know. So yeah. it was a good time. I mean, one time I remember. I got in a little bit of hot water because we're having nit noise. You've ever heard the term nit noise?
No.
Nit noise in Thai is very small.
Okay.
And these little motor scooters over there, like mopeds. Well, a lot of people had mopeds. So we'd be drinking, raising hell at night, and we'd have moped races out in the place we lived in Camp Friendship, it was called. Well, I wiped out on the moped and scraped my face all up. I couldn't wear my oxygen mask. And our squadron commander said, listen, the next guy that goddamn wipes out a nit noise and can't fly, he's in deep trouble. So I snuck out and went to NKP, the Confanom, to fly with the facts up there. They had kind of an exchange deal. We'd go up there. And NAOFAX, oh, those guys, I'm telling you, that I don't know what the hell they call their bar, but to be initiated into the bar, you had to drink a glass of vodka with grenadine in it. You can imagine. It was close to alcohol poisoning, for God's sake. So then I get up the next morning and go with a super guy. Jeez, I can't believe I can't think of his name. But anyway, we went on a four-hour mission working fighters. And then we landed at Phnom Penh, which was very interesting because they're dropping bombs within about 3 miles of Phnom Penh at the time. And we had lunch with the T-28 Cambodian squadron commander, and he gave me a nice flag, and it was really cool. So then we take off again and fly four more hours. So 8 hours in the backseat of an OV-10. Whew, I was wiped.
Yeah, after a night of solid drinking. Yeah. What was you went back to, so that was the first round of Karat,
right?
You go back. What was the difference between those two deployments? Was it a different environment, different tempo?
Very much so. Very much so. Now we were in the training mode when we went back there.
Okay.
Now, you know, if you can remember the A1E Sky Raiders, they were all the search and rescue guys, call sign of Sandy. And I'm telling you, Rain, they had big gonads. Those guys were tough. They had a lot of rescues that they did. Now, some up in North Vietnam that are unbelievable. So, So I went back to the third squadron. And we had to do a checkout at England Air Force Base, a search and rescue type, relatively short course, and then over to Karat, and then we were set an alert. We'd set 4 to 8 ship. I guess maybe it's only usually 4 airplanes. We set alert every morning or every day. And basically, I think, you know, the rumor was we were, because there's really no flying going around there. The Khmer Rouge had already taken over Cambodia. No, they hadn't quite yet, because they haven't, they hadn't evacuated Phnom Penh nor Saigon. But supposedly the Blackbirds were up there taking pictures. So we would be up and ready to go from then. But the mission was completely different. That search and rescue checkout, you know, I won't go into the gory details, but usually you run 6 airplanes. You had a Sandy High, a Sandy Low. You're working with Jolly Green Giants, the Jolly Green helicopters. You'd have OB-10s, and you're kind of the orchestrator of this whole thing. That's one of the toughest checkouts I've ever been through. But it was very gratifying. Unfortunately, I never got to pick anybody up. But that kind of leads into the my guess thing, which most young guys, and I certainly understand why most people, as far as that goes, that was in 1975. And if you want to hear about that, I'll kind of give you the high points there, because there's certainly some lessons learned on that.
Well, it's one of those things that until you mentioned it beforehand, I hadn't heard about it. So I went and read. I think it'd be interesting to hear what that incident was, your involvement in it, because it's one of those pieces of history that not that it will get lost otherwise.
It's forgotten, unfortunately. But, you know, the people that were alive then or whatever, it's a pretty interesting thing. So there again, I'll try to give you the high points. So we get, you know, that happened in, was it April? Yeah, April, from about April 12th to April 15th. The My Guess was a container ship. It had left Hong Kong. It's going around the south, and it was going to drop some stuff off in Thailand, I think. And now this was only about a few weeks after Saigon fell, and they had, I forget the code word for that, but one of them was frequent wind. That might have been the evacuation of Phnom Penh.
Okay.
But anyway, the Khmer Rouge had captured the My Guess. They had boarded it and took the crew. The crew of 41, I believe it was. It's a pretty good sized container ship, you know, just typical of what you would see.
And correct me if I'm wrong, the Khmer Rouge, that's a communist party that ended up taking over Cambodia, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The real Pol Pot, the real bad, bad guys that really doesn't get too much history, but it was god awful. I mean, they marched people out in the fields, and so many people, the killing fields. If you haven't heard of that term, it was a book written, and I didn't even think a movie, but it was pretty bad. So now it's kind of setting the stage here. The Ford was president. Kissinger was Secretary of State. Schlesinger was Secretary of Defense. And Rockefeller was Vice President, Nelson Rockefeller. Rumsfeld, who was actually the Chief of Staff to Ford. So these guys, it is a, if you really wanted to study it, they're running the whole thing from the White House. And somewhat like the Vietnam War. I mean, what a disaster. The thing was a disaster. So anyway, I'll get to the high point. So I get launched out of there. Everything's confusing. Nobody knows what the hell to do. So some of my squadron mates, they were down there, and they're just droning around trying to figure out, well, what the hell are we going to do? We're the crewmen. We got to rescue these crew. And we didn't know whether they were on the mainland of Cambodia, whether they were on an island. Well, the My Guess itself was anchored off of a island called Koh Tang. Cambodia, name for island is Koh. So everybody called it Koh Tang, but it's actually Tang. And so we didn't know, about the third day, I'm trying to think of the date, somewhere around the 13th, I think. I was down there with leading the 2 ship, and nothing was really going on. They had some AC-130s in the area. They had some RF-4s in the area taking pictures, and they had an AB-CCC. Are you familiar with that term? AB-CCC is Airborne Command and Control, and that's a C-130, kind of like a mini AWACS.
All right.
So we're just kind of droning around, checking out the Maiguez and everything. And he comes, ABCCC comes up and he says, oh, you won't believe this. They want you to strafe that gunboat. There was a gunboat between the Maiguez and Koh Tang Island, about the size of a tug, maybe.
Okay.
And they said, we had to authenticate that. I don't know whether you still do that with a CAC wheel and all this other stuff.
Yeah, you'll still do
so, it. So, you know, you could imagine there's not a fighter pilot around that doesn't want to strafe a boat.
Yeah. you are not wrong. And I do have a story about that, but you are not wrong.
1,000 rounds of 20 mic, Mike. 20 millimeter. And my second pass in there, so we average about 200 rounds, you know, which is quite a few.
Yep.
The second pass, I kind of hit the engine room. It feels like, ka-woom, big explosion goes up and everything else. And my wingy was so excited. He was a young lieutenant. He said, oh, man, Lee, you hit it. But anyway, and the RF4, guys, there's a little bit of a carnival thing. I'm making light of it, but it wasn't light. Now, the thing that I thought about later was that we didn't know where in the heck those American servicemen were. What if they would have been on that goddamn gunboat?
That's one of those things you just don't know. And I mean, I watch it now because I did Operation Inherent Resolve and it was a really busy time. And the Jocko podcast, I was just listening to that. He actually just had one, and it's one of these Yazidi women. They're interviewing and they're talking about being captive and the bombs falling on civilians and things like that, that you just don't know. And we were bombing checkpoints for a long period of time, or several weeks, right? Because ISIS is real big with checkpoints. Right. And that was all over the media. Well, they quickly figured that out, right? And they started putting prisoners up at checkpoints. So we no longer bomb checkpoints. But you do have to wonder, and you don't necessarily know, like, the enemy always gets a vote, and they're always going to try to be deceptive, and they're always going to try to control the narrative, especially in today's world. But that's one of those things that you just, it plays in the back of your mind. I don't know, that aspect didn't play in my mind when I was, I think, actively engaged in the news in the beginning, but it's something you think about afterwards.
Right. Well, if anybody's interested, I'll give you a link to a book too that was that I read that really shed some light on it. But anyway, so it was pretty shallow there. The gunboat, we sunk it, and they brought an AC-130 in after us, put some 105 howitzer shells on it. Yeah. Really did some damage to it. Okay, so that was, I think, right around the 14th, if I'm not correct. So we're out of there early the next morning. And it was confusing. What's this mission going to be? You had a question. Go ahead.
I was going to ask, so you're flying these sorties. Do you have a tanker that you're getting gas from, or are you guys just...
All the time.
Just how long are you hanging out on station for this?
You know, I'm just guessing 3 to 4 hours.
Okay. I imagine it's continuous coverage, too. You guys are ripping out with other fighters, and it's continuous coverage on this boat?
Yeah, not too many initially. Not too many. They had the RF4s taking pictures. And they had a Navy P-3 down there.
Okay.
But not initially. Now, okay, the high point was the 15th and the decision-making. That's why you need to read the book. If you're interested in it, it goes back on how these decisions were made and everything else. So the decision was made. We get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, whenever we're briefing. We're down there as the sun rising, and I'm leading a 3-ship. And there's airplanes everywhere. There's F-4s. I think there's 111s around. They are the Navy. They moved a carrier in there. It's hitting the mainland of Cambodia. And we're going to land Marines on Koh Tang Island. And there was a beach there. You'd have to look at the map and see. We call it the slingshot because it looked like a slingshot. And here's what haunts me, Rain. It haunts me to this day because nobody knew what the hell was going on. ABCCC, everybody's quiet. And I remember looking over the canopy rail and seeing kaboom. And then shortly thereafter, another explosion. I'm saying, man, the Navy's hammering the beach down there. Well, it wasn't the Navy. I saw 3 helicopters get shot down in about 5 minutes, killed a bunch of Marines. So now all hell's breaking loose. Are the survivors of the Maiguez, are the crew members on that island? Now, we worked with some of the PJs And there were some Jolly Greens involved in this thing. And, you know, they'd be keying their mic. They're running for their lives and saying, "Sandy, Sandy, we're taking fire. We're taking fire." You could hear the bullets or the guns and everything else. And I mean, what the hell do you do? There's no FAC involved. But anyway, I could go on and on about that. But now, wouldn't you know it, here's the bad mistake. But who knows? It's the random aspect of it. The crew of the Maiguez was released about an hour before we stormed the beach at Koh Tang Island. And they're in a Thai fishing boat headed back to their ship. And the intel was so bad, we didn't get it.
Gosh, who was
so
normally, at least I think nowadays, that type of mission, you would have a mission commander. So it'd be you, right? You would own the overall package, but right. Like, so technology, if you're at the same base, everyone can brief it together, but most likely in those operations, you're not. So you're gonna be doing some kind of secure, you know, teleconference, VTC. So it sounds like you guys, everyone's just kind of showing up, but I imagine
it was to a certain degree, it was.
And then when these helicopters get shot down, what happened then? Is anyone talking about that or trying to figure out where that's coming from, or like who's honcho in this effort?
Well, you know, ABCCC is the one that actually is supposed to be honchoing it. But here's what haunts me, you know, if I had the guy, you know, I'm a relatively young guy with not that much experience. I should have, looking back on, I should have said to something like ABCCC, crickets or call sign, cricket, what the hell's going on here? Are we going to land? Are those helicopters, where are they going to land at? Because there's two areas they could have. Because we got some ground fire from that area they put in, and there was about, I don't know, you get the different figures, 150 to 200 Khmer Rouge guys in there just waiting until those helicopters went into a cover, and then they opened up on them. So, but fast forwarding here, not spending too much time on it, there was a guy named Bob Undorf, I believe, OV-10 driver at NKP, that came down in the afternoon, because now what had happened, we went from an offensive land mission to a rescue mission. Now we got to get these Marines off the island because we got the crew members back. And he was trained. He knew what the hell to do. And he took command. And he got, by nightfall, really after nightfall, he got all the Marines out. Now, here's the sad thing, if you want to read the books. And I've got some. Ralph Wetterhahn wrote a pretty good book called The Last Battle of Vietnam. But anyway, here's the bottom line. We left three guys there. Three Marines were left. And it's a sad, sad state, I'll tell you.
Those are the last three names that are on the Vietnam.
Yes, sir, they are.
So one thing I will say, all the books you've mentioned, we'll get those. Right. I'll put that up on the Afterburn podcast because this episode, it'll have a page sure. there. So people are interested in hearing about it. And that's the one thing that this is 3 days, right? And I'll be honest, I was ignorant to it prior to you mentioning it. And I right. venture to say that's the vast majority of people, but Americans lost their lives doing the job of the nation. You don't want to forget those. And I think that's why it's important to capture these stories, because there's so much. 3 days, and we've just talked about it in about 15 minutes. But there's so much more we really can dive into. And it's wild to me. Do you think there's all the it is clear in history that Washington was running the war at that time. Do you think that was a factor in this incident, or was it just there wasn't the infrastructure in place to coordinate such a large scale attack on the fly or operation on the fly? Is that, does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. It was the culture really held over from Vietnam, you know, as far as the White House. I mean, they're choosing targets in Washington, D.C. So it was the same type thing. But, you know, if you study the books we'll put on your website, the thing of it was they wanted to, we just got our butts kicked leaving Vietnam. The morale was horrendous. So Kissinger and Ford, basically, they wanted to do some heavy military. They wanted to hurt people. And they kind of sacrificed the crew to a little bit, some of the decisions they made. So, but to answer your question, there is no doubt. Now, you compare that to the Desert Storm situation. Obviously, Desert Storm was much, much bigger and everything, but it was a completely different attitude. How in the hell we handled that one?
Right. We learned centralized command, decentralized execution, you know, is one of the pillars, I think, out of all of this.
No question.
Yeah. Trust your people. Train them and trust your people. That's
right.
So that kind of wraps up Karat and those two points. You're back stateside. Again, if people are interested in reading about that, I'll put more information up on the website. And it'd be great to, we'll do like an informal thing with the Patreons, maybe do a happy hour where we can discuss this more.
Sure, you bet.
It's interesting to me. I know people find it interesting. So you come back after your second tour there. And then, like you said, you go to the T-38. Is that correct?
That's correct. In Holloman. I went to T-38 in Holloman. So that would have been 1975, towards the tail end. Now, I wasn't too happy about that.
I would imagine. So did you go straight? You come back to the squadron in Myrtle Beach and then change stations? Or it was straight from Karat back to, or straight to the T-38?
Yeah, I was out of Myrtle Beach. I wasn't going back there once I PCS'd, as they call it.
Yep, same. So, okay.
To Karat. So I went right to Holloman in the T-38. And most of the guys, the IPs, were not all that fired up to be there. But I'm telling you, we can talk about it. It was one of the most gratifying assignments I had.
Why was it gratifying?
Well, the gratification came from teaching young guys that I could identify with. I wasn't that old, that were fired up, that were going to F-4s, some to A-7s. I mean, the F-16 wasn't in the picture quite yet. They were doing some testing on it and everything. And we flew a lot, quite a few FAPEs came through there, which you're familiar with. And it was, and plus, besides, we called it the White Rat. I don't know whether you call it the White Rat or the White Rocket or whatever.
Well, it was gray by the time I went through.
Well, we camouflaged those T-38s. But you know, out of all the airplanes that I've flown, that 38 is the most fun airplane, just to strap it on, crank it up and go flying. I mean, it was wonderful. And we flew the hell out of that airplane because so many times, you know, guys coming out of UPT, I mean, you're kind of spoon fed a little bit, whatever. You don't get to max perform the airplane. And it was one of my favorite things. Said, hey, you ever done a max aileron roll in this thing? Oh, sir, we can't do that. It's against the rules. The reason it's against the rules is because it's so damn fast. Yeah. It's 720 degrees per second. So I'd say, okay, let me demo one. So I'd roll about 10 times. 1, 2, 3, 4. I loved that airplane. I absolutely loved it. And the gratifying thing to me was teaching young guys, okay, they're coming in and, you know, okay, we're going to, let's basic air to BFM, basic fighter maneuvers. And, you know, you'd mention, okay, high yo-yos, low yo-yos, barrel roll attack. Well, they're looking, what the hell are you talking about? And it was fun for me to sit in the back seat. And when they got it, you could literally see their helmet light up. That's what you mean. That's very, very gratifying.
I agree. No one really wants to be a FAPE, I don't think. I enjoyed my time doing it. And I would say it was definitely very rewarding for that same aspect, right? You take someone who's straight off the street, and then in 3 or 4 months, they're flying on the wing in the weather, 3 feet from their classmate, doing some crazy thing. And that, to me, when they get it right, you're like, obviously the words I'm saying might make some sense, and they're able to translate that into flying ability. And it is rewarding for sure. I think any instructor would attest to that.
Oh, no question. I'm sure they will. You know, and the fun thing about the 38, we had modified that. We put an A37 gun sight in it. We put a hard point on where you carry a SU-20 with 6 practice bombs.
Okay.
And then we had a 9.62 Gatling gun we hung underneath it.
Wrong time for me. By the time I got there, it was digital, you know? So you got to do IFF, what we were calling it, Introduction to Fighter Fundamentals versus Fighter Right. Gun. Same. It was all digital, you know? You're just counting digital beans.
Well, that's a conversation for another time. I would love to find out because, you know, I really didn't follow it, but I know that's what they did. But it was kind of a fun thing, no question about it. I got a quick little story here that maybe have a little wisdom in it if you got time.
I got nothing but time.
Okay, the T-38 story was I flew with a young guy. He was going to A-7s, and he was in the Puerto Rican Air National Guard. He was just a good looking, looked like Omar Sharif, you know, with his mustache. He was just a good kid, you know?
Yeah.
He was the most, before I tell you that, when I used to give a briefing, I'd draw a line up on the blackboard. Whiteboard then. And I would say, okay, here's the line. I want on this side is aggressiveness. I want you to be as aggressive as you can. I want you to hover on that line. Now, if you overstep that line, this area is called the dumb shit line. You're going to hurt yourself. You don't want to do that. So, okay, do you understand that? Okay, now this young kid, he was the most aggressive student I've ever flown with. I mean, I'm flying an air to air, and before I know it, he's slowed down. The guy spits out in front of us. They're in a kind of a scissors. He throws the flaps down. And I said, Roberto, was his name, Roberto, what the hell are you doing?
Max performing.
He said, oh, no, I can slow up. I said, you do that again, you're in big trouble. You're going to forget about him. You're going to overspeed him. Yes, sir. Guess what? We start another one. Bam, down come the flaps. I'm saying, Roberto, okay, that's it. I got it. Go back. You took the ride.
He's max performing the plane. I can respect that. The full envelope, you know?
Well, that's the fun part of it. The sad thing, Rain, he killed himself in an A7 about 3 months later.
How'd he kill himself?
A DM. Now, I don't know exactly. I mean, I had somebody call me up for an accident investigation board because I put in his grade book, you know, that you kind of got to temper that aggressiveness. And he departed an A7, didn't get out of it, and ended up augering in and killing himself. So it's a bummer.
Yeah, it's a dangerous business. But the thing that most people don't get who don't fly fighters, the whole point is max performing that plane, taking it to its limit, right? But not exceeding the limit. Because like you, as you've described, it kind of goes from, you got to be right there on the line of aggressiveness. Once you cross over, it can trickle into recklessness.
No question.
You know, and it's a fine line.
What it boils down to? Judgment.
Yeah. That's what that line is, right? That's where you know.
No question.
Because it's not defined, and you got to know where the line is, and that's where the judgment piece comes in.
Absolutely. I used to, you know, avoid stupidity before seeking brilliance. And, you know, I used to tell my students, hey, listen, you get just as much fun out of flying 150 feet as you do 50 feet. So,
valid. Not that 100 feet is going to give you that much of a buffer, but it's something.
Right. Exactly. So anyway, I did the 38 stuff, you know, and the only other quick story I have is we used to fly pop-ups, you know, right down in the weeds, pop up to a 30-degree dive bomb or whatever. It was a fun mission. Fun. So I can't remember. Yeah, I was in the back seat. So we come back and the next day or a day later, there was one of the 38s, the goddamn wing come off right at the wing root. Boom, punched out. The guy survived, no good problem.
Yeah, okay.
But guess what airplane it was? The one I was doing pop-ups on. If that wing comes off, I'm a dead man, along with my student, because you can recover at that altitude.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of things in there. Oh, I forgot one A7 story I got to tell you. Oh, no, we're not. Yeah, we're.
Yeah,
I forgot one A7.
Yeah,
story.
This is great.
Okay, this is a good one too. To where you show a little luck, I'll try to keep it short. But anyway, towards the end of the program, we had because the instructor used to go up with three students, so I'm number two.
Okay,
we're coming down initial over Tucson. I'm sure you've been to DM. I mean, it's pretty close to downtown on landing, whatever direction. I can't remember. So he gives us a cross under. So I'm number two. I go behind lead. I said, okay, fine. It looks like I got enough room here. Ooh, look, now I'm not going to say anything. I move up and hit the wing of number three with my wing.
Okay.
Take about a foot off of it. Maybe not that much. And can you imagine? So Greg Johnson was the guy's name. You know, he was a cool dude. But anyway, I land and there's the goddamn 06 car waiting on me. He's up there looking at the wing. I know I'm in deep trouble. Here's a quick story. I had the DO at the time, a full colonel, rip me up one side and down the other. And rightfully so. I tried driving an airplane where there's no room. I mean, I walked out of there bleeding bad, I'll tell you. So then I had to go see the wing commander, who was a guy named Fred Hafner. He didn't look anything like a fighter pilot, a little overweight, but the greatest guy. And I come down, he said, just have a seat there on my couch. He said, you know, Lieutenant, he says, when you get those wings, you get a little bag of luck with them. He said, you just used a little bit of that luck. Dismissed.
No, yeah. That's the guy you
now,
want
the
work
funny
for.
Part, the guy that chewed my ass out, I go to the Pentagon on an astro tour. Guess who my boss is? That guy. For a short time, then he left.
Well, usually when you bump planes together, it doesn't work out well.
No.
And it usually results in a rocket ride, best case scenario. So the fact that you're able to land it, you know, learn from it, that's a win in my book.
Well, it was a learning experience, yeah. But it could have been catastrophic over the middle of Tucson. Oh my God.
Well, it's a game of inches, right? And
no question. You know that for sure.
Yeah. I mean, anyone, and I just did an interview with Purdy, who's the RAF Red Arrow's leader. He ejected out of a Harrier, and his scenario at the end of it, people listen to the podcast, is he had all these senior guys come up to him and they all tapped him on the shoulder and said, hey, you know, the difference between you and me is I just got lucky, right? Because they'd all done this profile that he was flying and they managed. But again, it's a matter of maybe it's just a little bit warmer that day. This motor's producing a little bit thrust, a little less thrust, whatever it might be. It's a game of inches. You can go left or right one way or the other, and it's either completely catastrophic or you're walking away and you're telling the story at the bar and laughing about it. So, again, it's that line you were talking about between aggressiveness, recklessness, the judgment. Again, it comes down to the wire, I think, in a lot of cases.
You bet. No question about it.
Well, I'm glad you made it. That's a good lieutenant story, you know?
Yeah, that's a good one.
So we'll jump because that was prior to going to Karat. You're back flying T-38s, and then you said you ended up going up to the F-5 weapons school.
Yeah, I went to the F-5 weapons school, which was a hard decision for me because always in the back of my mind, man, I'd like to be an airline pilot. I like the lifestyle, you know, traveling around, young flight attendants in the back.
Yeah, rough life.
So I always wanted to do that, but this was such a great opportunity. I wanted to fly the F-5 too. And, you know, to get an S prefix in front of my name is kind of a feather in your cap. But at that time I was still pretty motivated. So, so I went to Willie and checked out in the F-5. I think I had one or two two-seat rides, but that the F-5E was a neat airplane. It was, you know, anybody that has ever flown it. I mean, they use it as aggressor. I don't think the Air Force flies anymore. I think the Navy might.
Yeah, I know the Marines do for sure. I don't know about the Navy. And then a lot of contract Red Air, they still fly it today. It'd be a fun plane to fly. I want to fly it.
Exactly. And, you know, the Nellis boys, not to denigrate any of the patch wearers, but they kind of look down their nose a little bit. Oh, well, you didn't go through Nellis. You didn't do this. You can't wear the real patch. So, but, you know, I got an S prefix. So I don't hold. It's no big deal. But it was a fun deal. It was great flying. And these guys, two Iranian guys I went with, they had like well over 1,000 hours in the airplane. And they were very good. The South Korean, all those guys were very good. The instructors were fantastic. And so I thoroughly enjoyed that. even though it was a lot of studying and everything else. But I picked up a, was it a 5-year commitment or a 3-year commitment?
Okay.
Out of that. So
what year were you flying F-5 weapons school?
Okay, that would have been around 1977.
Okay, the reason I'm asking, I'm trying to do math here, but obviously our partnership with Iran probably came to an end shortly after your time there.
Pretty close to that. Now, I know it was a little bit later because it's another story, but I briefed Reza Pahlavi, the Shah of Iran's son,
okay,
at the Pentagon on a red flag deal. And he went through pilot training in the U.S., if you knew that.
I didn't know it, but it makes sense. Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of people don't realize, too, you know, at Columbus Air Force Base, for instance, I think there's like 50-some-odd partner nations that go through pilot training with us. We have NATO Joint Jet Pilot Training out at Shepherd, and that's where people think mostly international. But, I mean, there are African countries I had never heard of. I'm not very smart, so take that with a grain of salt. But we partner with a lot of nations, and obviously those nations are always in flux. So it's interesting to see.
Yeah, very much so. So, this Iran must have fell, or the Shah did. It's right around 79. I could be wrong. You know,
79 was the number that was in my mind. But again, I'll caveat, I'm not very smart. So,
but the whole thing was fun. I really don't have any high points. The only thing I remember, I almost bought the farm. You know where Bought the Farm came from?
No. Yeah, I know the term.
Know until somebody told me the other day that I've been reading. When World War I fighter pilots, they got an insurance for $10,000 when they went to the war. And if they got killed, they'd cash out their insurance enough to buy the farm, because most of them were farmers. So that's where the term came from. But anyway, I almost bought the farm because back that F-5, believe it or not, had a they didn't call it a counter drum altimeter. It was one with the 3 points on the damn thing. You can misread it.
Yeah.
I misread it 10,000 feet and dusted off the goddamn desert floor.
You are not the first person to do that. And I'm sure you're not the last person to do that.
No question. No question.
Yeah. What were you doing when that happened?
We were doing some sort of an air to air mission.
Good. So. Yeah, it makes me cringe. Because that's something, it's such a minor mistake, right?
Yes.
That's the attention to detail, but it could happen to anyone.
No, so true. But I enjoyed flying it. What was a neat little thing about it, if not too many people know, they had a nose wheel extension on the darn thing before takeoff. You didn't take off if that nose wheel extension didn't work. And increase the AOA of the wing.
Interesting.
So, you know, we're there with T-38s and T-37s and at Willie there. And, you know, we used to raise our nose wheels with in formation, which was, we thought we were cool. But
yeah,
have any real high points, even though the guys were good. They were tough, you know, tough debriefs. I mean, the typical type of stuff.
I was looking at your resume too. This is kind of jump a little bit, but do you have any involvement with MiGs?
Very interesting. You mentioned that. Now, okay, I'll get to that because I got another book too that we can talk about. Okay, so F-5s, I go back to Holloman for about a year and then I go to the Pentagon. Now, I was supposed to go to personnel in the Pentagon. Somehow there was an acquaintance, not a close friend, acquaintance saw my name, said I was going to personnel. And I ended up in the fighter shop in the basement of the Pentagon.
Okay.
It was another stroke of luck.
Better be lucky than good.
I did, because they took their guy that wasn't a fighter guy and he went to personnel. And I ended up, he never forgave me. He was a great guy too. He was a great guy. But I ended up in XOOTT was the thing of it. It was in operations, the basement of the Pentagon. And okay, I did that. It was I shouldn't be name droppers, but I will. I worked with two guys there. one a lot more than others. These guys were Patriot, fighter pilot, F-4 guys mostly, and they were just super guys, hardworking. And one of the guys was John Jumper.
Okay, yeah.
If the Jumper, how could you forget that right. name, huh?
Hey, Johnny Jumper. He got a few stars.
He was my mentor. So he was a major, I was a captain, and he ended up being chief of staff of the Air Force. A quick aside, when he made chief of staff, I kind of lost contact with him and everything through the years, but I found out, I sent him an email, and, John, I'm proud of you. You're my mentor. You're, you know, yada, yada. And I said, by the way, I can still kick your butt on the racquetball court. He said, bring it on. And the other one who worked in Operation Checkmate, they called it, was Dickie Myers.
Okay.
General Myers yeah. was the work for Rumsfeld. So I'm thinking, I'm telling you, I'm a total failure and a loser. But those guys were super guys. And I'm so happy that they did so well, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. So I worked with a guy there who was an F-4 guy named Gail Peck. Now, there was another gentleman named Bill Sakahar that was working on super duper top secret stuff. Now, all this stuff has been declassified now. And what they were doing was building a facility up north in Tonopah and they were out getting MiGs surreptitiously or however the hell they got them, you know. Yeah. Do you know anything about this, Rain? Does that ring a bell for you or is that way past your time?
No, well, I mean, it was past my time, but General Carlisle, who actually checked me out for the demo, uh-huh. he's actually punched out from one. And it's a small world aviation. So the guy who got me involved, I would say kind of put me on this path, was a neighbor. He's a Delta pilot, former Air Force. But he and General Carlisle were roommates at the academy, you know? So when I did sure. my checkout with General Carlisle, I had that connection. So it's a small world, especially in the aviation realm, where you kind of see, it's 3 degrees of separation, I feel like.
Oh, no question about it. It's amazing, isn't it? The fraternity is pretty darn small. So anyway, Gail Peck was working on it, and I didn't even know anything about it. I mean, it was super top secret. And then I got briefed in or something. I can't remember exactly why. But most of these guys were flying aggressors, F5s. Well, I had F5 time. So it was saying, well, if you can cut it, maybe. And I had orders, believe it or not, for Nellis
okay.
aggressors. So Peck on the side says, well, if you can hack it, maybe. You know, you can go up and fly the types. They call them the types right there. Now, the book, if you're interested, if anybody's interested, it's a great book written by Gail Peck, and we can put that on there, The America's Secret MiG Squadron. So I won't go into any details or anything else, but it was a tough decision, as you can imagine. That'd have been pretty cool.
Yeah.
Feathering the cap and everything sure. else. If I could have hacked it, I'm not saying I would have, but I decided to get out. So that's the story. And I met a lot of those guys that were flying. And, you know, it was really so damn secret that some other friends that were up there were aggressors saying, oh, man, you better think about this because these guys can't tell anybody what the hell they're doing. They can't even tell their family. And they're traveling a lot and yada, yada. But it was that whole operation was put together by some really gung-ho guys, I'll tell you.
It's impressive. I'm definitely not the smart guy, but it's nice to know there's smart people out there solving complex problems. I got some buddies who disappear for a few weeks. And I know 20 years from now, we'll see whatever they're working on flying around, which is pretty absolutely. Cool to say. But it's, I don't know, it's fun and it's interesting and it's pretty impressive just to see what people are capable of doing. If only I could
really,
do something.
Yeah. Really, because there's probably some things that it would say, holy moly, you know damn well
yeah.
what they're doing. But yeah, that was a very interesting thing. My job at the Pentagon was red flag. I tried to keep all the generals smart on red flag.
Okay.
Now, I never met the guy, which bummed me out a little bit. There was a guy named Moody Souter, who was an F-4 driver, a Southeast Asia veteran.
Okay.
He's the one that came up with the concept of red flag. If you can get 10 missions in, your survival rate goes way, way up. So it was, and he worked right there in my office, in the office that I worked in.
That's small.
And, you know, here's a guy nobody knows about, and he didn't really strive to get the attention or anything else. He was just a hardworking fighter pilot, and he made it happen.
That's what I love about this community, because there are so many individuals. There are people who will shoot down a MiG, their name will go on buildings, they'll get bases named after them, whatever it might be. But again, the company that you're in, I've connected with people that I never would have connected with before, like-minded individuals that automatically you have the rapport and the trust with that is pretty unique. It's a fraternity, as right. You said.
Right.
So you end up getting out. I know that was a tough decision.
Going
to the airlines, but you keep flying in the fast jet business. So, well, I say fast jet business, you went to the A-10. So, you know, what was the transition like to the A-10 as well as going through the airline training? Because you're doing all that and juggling. It's a good bit to juggle.
Far from fast airplanes and the Warthog, but hey, it's a great mission. If I remember right, I heard one of your podcasts that said you wanted to fly the A-10 initially.
So, that's true. You did call me out on that. I did want to fly the A-10. I think probably like every fighter pilot, I wanted to get in the mix. I'm joining in Afghanistan, Iraq has been going on, and I'm a FAPE, so I feel like I'm missing it. The one thing I wanted to do was get into the fight. And I felt like the A-10, you're going to go do close air support. That was the fight. Fortunately, doing that MC-12 stint while I was a FAPE, it was a good exposure. Met a lot of great people, cool mission set, more tools for the bag of tricks. But glad I moved on from that. But the exposure I had to the individuals flying the F-16 with me, or F-16 pilots, that's what opened my aperture, opened up my radar, if you will. To know, hey, there's really an awesome platform out there that does a lot of things, which I was ignorant to because I was just either naive or I didn't research it enough or I made some assumptions I shouldn't have. So it worked out. Do I still want to shoot that gun? Yeah, you bet. But going fast and doing everything the F-16 does, that's where you want to be in life. My biased opinion.
I'm so fortunate. I'm so lucky to have flown both of them and experienced both of them for quite a length of time, really.
Yeah. Great.
And so, you know, the A-10 was relatively new. We didn't have too much magic stuff in there. But I got a local checkout. I didn't have to go to the schoolhouse. And it was fun as hell.
Yeah.
I flew out of Syracuse. And we literally had the Latin area, Latitude Tactical Navigation Area, all the way up over the Adirondacks.
Yeah.
And it was some of the most beautiful territory. And we'd do our bombing and strafing up to Fort Drum. And it was just a great mission down in the weeds. I mean, you'd take off. There's several missions when the weather would be somewhat dicey and hell, you wouldn't even get above 1,000 feet. You know, you'd be in there dropping level bombs and you could imagine the weather in Syracuse, that I used to call it. Those guys are going to hate me for it because they hated the guys that live up there. But some of the weather we had, oh my God, unbelievable. So I did a local checkout, you know, did the normal things, had several different ORIs, and we flew around I never did go to Europe. Our squadron went to Europe. They went over to Germany. They might have flown the airplane over there. I can't even remember, but I flew that
weeks.
For about 7.5 years.
Yeah, not bad. And then you end up transitioning to the F-16, right through Syracuse. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah, we come. So then we went to the F-16. So that would have been right around 89, maybe 90, to the A model.
Okay.
Which was, they call it the small tail. I mean, those things have been in the desert forever, but it was a pretty hot machine. And we got checked out in that, and shortly thereafter, Desert Storm started. And I'd have to look at the calendar and see exactly how many days and everything. So then, you know, to tell you the truth, the Desert Storm thing, I could have probably got out of it, Rain. I was an older guy. I was about 43 years old. I could have weenied out and retired. I couldn't live with myself, you know? So besides, it was kind of, it was an adventure.
Well, what was Desert Storm like for you?
It was a hell of a lot different than Vietnam and Cambodia, I'll tell you that.
Did you guys, were you PSAB or where were you guys out of?
We were out of Al Karj.
Okay.
Now, they might have renamed Al Karj. I don't know. It was a kind of a forward operating area right around Riyadh.
Okay. I mean, I'm not super familiar with it. I fly over.
Right.
That's about all I want to do. You know, but.
Well, it was about 5.5 months. We lived in tents, but it wasn't that bad because they were air conditioned.
Slumming it Air Force style.
I'm telling you what, I mean, and then all the guys up in Beer Rain, we call it, they're living in hotels and having a big time. But we flew 13.5 hours over there, which was kind of a highlight. And the poopy suit, we had two lieutenants to wear them, and all the rest of the guys said, no, those poor lieutenants were, they were miserable by the time they got there.
Yeah, that's a long time in a poopy suit. It's a long time in a Viper, period.
Oh, man. Oh, man. So, you know, 3-6 ships, 30 minutes apart. I was leading the last one. We got there. There was a dust storm. And the tanker said, okay, I'm see you guys. I said, he's going up to Riyadh. I said, no way, pal. You're staying right here with us till we get in. Because we had no instrument approaches.
Yeah.
So our ops officer at the time, he was on the ground in Mobile and said, okay, fly this. We had a TACAN. Fly this radio. Let down 200 feet on the radio altimeter. See if you see anything. So...
What?
So I came in and I'll never forget. I said, okay, every man for himself. They took radar trail. I come in, I come across about a 30 degree. I see the landing lights. I land. All five guys went around. But then the weather cleared up and they came back around and landed. But the point I wanted to say is I'll never forget. I went down de-armed, come back, and there was a South Carolina. We were over there with McIntyre.
Okay.
And there was a South Carolina crew chief. The dust was blowing, and he had these Rommel goggles on. And I raised the canopy. I'm exhausted, as you well know. You've probably done those long, long hops. And he puts the ladder up, comes up, and I'm getting unhooked. And he looks at me, and he says, "Welcome to hell." So... But anyway, the Desert Storm thing, that story's been told many, many times. I mean, it started out where, you know, the intel guys said, oh, 10% of you guys aren't coming back. Yikes, which got our attention.
Yep.
But it turned out they really didn't have the will to fight. So many MiGs went to Iran. And, you know, the Weasels did a great job over there, the F-4 Weasels and the Jammers, F-111s. And it was the way... As I'm sure you've heard, this is the way to fight the goddamn war.
Yeah, textbook.
I mean, we hit them with everything. I think they had a buff strike like every 30 minutes for days. And my concern was after those first 3 or 4 days was running into another airplane, because you could imagine it was like World War II with contrails are going everywhere.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, that's what we always joke. Now red flag is usually a deconfliction flag, but I imagine you know, the skies are filled. Were you guys doing a lot of strike missions, or is it close air?
Yeah, that's all we did. We did fly some mid-cap, you know, later on and stuff, but we started out with 16 ship gaggles, you know, going against mostly SA-6s and up near Baghdad, and then a lot of stuff in Basra. And we were the F-16, the little known fact was we were the only squadron that, because we were kind of a close air support unit from the A-10 to the F-16 up Syracuse, and we had 30 millimeter gun pods. So we had one day we carried the 30 millimeter gun pod, which was kind of cool. And then I don't know, for whatever reason, they didn't use it again, you know, but I remember chasing an 18-wheeler down a hardball road with that 30-millimeter gun pod. I guess I'm not proud of it, but it was fun.
Well, you know, he shouldn't have been a bad guy.
You know, but I remember I was coming in there and it made a pretty, got pretty low, and I hear see the tires light up, you know, smoke coming out of it. And I thought to myself, man, you should be going faster, not slowing down.
Yeah, no joke. Could you, if you use that 30-millimeter gun pod, could you still use the 20-millimeter? Was it disabled or?
Great question. No, you could.
That's a lot.
No, let me see. You know, looking back on it, I didn't even think about that. Maybe they disconnected it. Obviously, you had the trigger for the 30-millimeter gun pod. So that's a great question, Rain. I didn't even think of it.
I didn't know the 30-millimeter gun pod was even a thing for the F-16. So I'm learning a lot today.
Of course. Not many people did.
Because I've heard stories, guys, they're just hot pitting and they're turning constantly. They're loading them up with Mark 84s and it's just one after another, or Mark 82s, dumb bombs. They're just doing 20-degree attacks, but they would fly 8 hours in a day and they might hot pit two or three times, you know, which we do at training, you know, to go fight BFM, but never to go out there just to hop across the border, drop a bunch of Mark 84s and then go back. Were you guys doing that kind of stuff too? Is that a normal day in the life?
We were quite a ways from the war. So we would hot pit refuel every time coming home to top it off. And, but we weren't doing a lot of turns out of there. You know, if we flew, you know, over 4.5-5 hours, we'd be tanking most of the time. But I understand, you know, those bases that were closer, I mean, they're flying a hell of a lot. They're hot pit going out again, but we did drop, quite a few 2000 pounders. We dropped them with 50-foot radar fuse, which is one hell of a weapon.
That's a crowd pleaser.
Oh man, I tell you. So, and the targets were so much better there. I mean, there's a guy named Buster Clausen. He was the general over there. Unfortunately, he got some hot water and ended up retiring. But he was a typical fighter pilot. He came to Al Karsh and briefed us on us. And, you know, he was a very colorful guy, you know. And he said, this ain't no stinking Vietnam we're going to do. We ain't bringing no goddamn bombs back.
You know? Yeah,
entertaining. He was very entertaining.
Tough to do but, these days.
You know, our squadron commander was an F-4 Marine guy. Froggy was his name. Just a wonderful guy. God rest his soul. He said at the tail end, he said, well, it's nice to win one for a change.
So, one of the W column. Finally got one of those.
Right.
Well, so you're doing all this. And we've talked a lot about your military career. But you also had a very successful airline career. And I'm just looking at it here, 727, 737, 747, and 777. Multiple airlines, and as you alluded to in the beginning, you only spent 3 weeks as a first officer. So right place, right time. I always say that's a big deal. And sometimes you hit it, sometimes you don't. But I would say it sounds like you nailed it when it comes to a flying career, and a very successful one at that.
Total luck. A lot of, you know, you kind of make your own luck. I made the decision, but I remember when, you know, at Holloman, when I'm getting ready to get out, that'd be February of 81. And, you know, guys, friends would come in. Now, wait a second. He said, what the hell are you thinking of? You're getting out. Nobody's hiring. I had an interview with Eastern. They canceled it. Nobody's hiring. And I read about this, a company, a startup in Newark, New Jersey, called People Express Airlines. And so I pursued that. Make a long story short, I got hired and I went to Newark. And it was, I went through two bankruptcies with Continental, thinking I'd, you know, when I was at Desert Storm, I didn't think I was going to have a job to coming back. In fact, I tried to get an interview with Emirates.
Wow, yeah.
And I even went to Dubai to their offices there to talk to their chief pilot, who was an Indian guy. And he said, basically, you don't have any last cockpit time. We're not interested. Jesus, I mean, the F-16's got a heads-up display. What do you mean?
Right.
But anyway, that's an aside. But yeah, I was lucky. And, you know, the thing of it is, you hear fighter pilots would say, oh, man, who in the hell? Why would you want to drive a bus around? But, you know, now being flying 777s, it's just a different animal, and it's still fun. And believe it or not, I probably had more emergencies in the 747 than I had in any other airplane. So
yeah, there you go.
We could go into some of those if you want to, but yeah, they're pretty interesting.
Yeah, you know, that's one thing that you, when you're flying a single seat, single engine plane, and you have an emergency, mayor of cockpit city, the stress level is usually pretty high, or can be, depends upon what it is. But when you're flying a 600,000 pound airplane over vast stretches of the ocean, or even over land, right? If you have an issue, there's some complexities there that can be pretty challenging.
For sure.
What's some of the hairiest things you've seen in the old 747?
You know, there's another story before getting into this. Every guy that wants to pursue any career, really, aviation, whatever, you're going to have adversity. And before I get to that, just a quick blurb. Okay, I get out of Holloman. I go to United Training Center to get a 737 type rating. Okay, that would have been early 81. The only thing I'm going to say is, here's a dumb shit fighter pilot. And they made the mistake of sticking me with an F-15 guy who's a prince of a guy. And two fighter pods together is not good. We had an instructor, an older guy. He was anything but motivated, wouldn't give us any extra time. Now, I'm not necessarily blaming him, but I am a little bit. And then before we know it, he writes back to the company and say, these guys are not going to make it. You know,
yeah,
they have problems. And V1 cuts, you know what V1 yeah. cuts are. Well, this is, so, you know, to make a long story as short as I can't sleep. I'm worried what I find out about this. I'm out of the Air Force. What the hell? I can't get in the airlines. I said, this can't be right here. I finished number one in pilot training. This guy tells me I can't fly. So anyway, we have kind of a check ride to say, okay, whether you're going on or whether you're not, here's another bit of luck, Rain. You know who that instructor was? A United pilot instructor doing SAMs, an old F-100 pilot. And he says, hey, these guys are no problem. Give me one ride with them. They'll be ready for a check ride.
Right. It's funny. So it's funny you say that.
Yeah,
you know, my ATP check ride, my ATP partner was a Hornet guy.
Yeah,
we were in a program with a bunch of other military pilots. I think we were the only two fighter guys. We're like, why did you put us together? We don't know. Like, none of this makes sense. Like, can I be with the C-130 guy and he be with the KC-10 guy? Like, we need a seeing eye person here. And then same as once I started with the airline, going through the sim, I'm paired with an Osprey guy, and they're heavy guys in our group. And prior regional guys, I'm like, maybe we could split these two dum-dums up and give us someone who can help me, because I don't know what a V1 cut is, but yeah, you figure it out. It's a different way of flying.
And of course,
just,
it is.
You just got to get some exposure to it, and it's a different challenge. So,
of course,
I figured out how to step on the rudder. Although, you know, the 777, you really don't have to. They make us.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that the F-100 guy taught us how to do V1 cuts. He said, okay, don't even rotate the airplane. I'm going to fail an engine. Just keep it on the center line. That was a little tip that made all the difference in the world. But anyway, so yeah, this 37 I flew. I loved the 727. I flew it for about 7 years. If I could have only had one more approach and landing, I could have figured out how to land the damn thing. Good. It was the hardest airplane. I swear to God, the picture looks good. Everything is good. Nice landing. The next one would be a spine cruncher. But it was a fun airplane. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Okay, my best 747 story, and it's funny and it's very serious. I'm coming out of Brussels. And we had a full load, and I think that we put, I think it's 455 people on that thing.
Wow.
It was a lot of people the way we had it configured.
Okay. Yeah.
So we're heavier in hell. And there is a young guy getting flight engineer training. We didn't have any two-seaters. It's all old airplanes. Okay. We got from Alitalia, I think. So he's got an FE instructor. So the instructor is watching the brand new. It was his second ride. We went to Brussels, and then it's his second one. Okay, we're loaded up, got plenty of gas on board, taking off out of Brussels, and my leg, and just 10 knots below V1, which is a decision speed, as you well know. Kaboom, left engine blows up. So initially, I said, oh, my God, we blew some tires here. I'm thinking to myself, but no, it was the left engine. So below V1, I'm unbelievable. So, bam, I on the binders, and I think we had auto brakes, tell you the truth, and we selected max or whatever. 12,000-foot runway, we went right to the end.
Oh, man.
So now I look down. Number two engine's EGT is pegged. And the engineer instructor said, oh, my God, look at those brake temp indicators pegged in the red. So now I said, oh, man, we're going to blow some tires here. So I tell the engineer, the student engineer, shut down two. And we're talking to tower. We start taxiing off, and they're bringing fans out, the big fans, to cool those tires down. Because I'm surprised that we didn't pop any tires yet. I look down as we're coming off the runway, and I look at number two engine. I said, Jesus, it's still pegged. I look at the cutoffs. He'd shut down number three.
Oh, man.
Instead of number two.
Oh, man. Yeah.
So I just reached down and shut two down. And I can't remember whether we started the other one. I think we started the other one. But the thing of it is, the very serious thing about this, and it shows you, even in commercial aviation, if we'd have got airborne and he'd have shut the wrong engine down, two shot, threes down, we're dead, and along with 450 people.
There are several accidents out there that I know you are probably familiar with that I've gone through where that exact scenario has happened. The C-5 out of Dover.
Yes.
You know, shutting the wrong, that's one that really pops in my mind, shutting the wrong motor down. I think we've actually had some recent ones. I got to go back and read some of the reports, but yeah, inadvertently shutting the wrong motor down. It can happen. And that's the thing. It's a minor thing of it's an easy thing to do too. And you can see in the heat of the moment that anyone
we're
can do
human.
It. Yeah. It's
we
so
human
easy.
Human mistakes.
Man.
Whew. Man, the wine tasted good at that night.
Yeah, better be lucky than good.
No question. I'm a perfect example of it. So anyway, I can't believe we didn't blow any tires. We get the people off the airplane. They bust them out of there and everything else. And then we went around and they brought the platform out. We're looking at that number two engine. And there's molten metal everywhere. I mean, it's shot, so we're not going anywhere. So now here's where kind of a judgment comes in. Now, if we throw this young engineer under the bus, he's through, more than likely. He's in deep trouble. So the engineer instructor, he was a super guy, Nick Hook, Dr. Hook, we called him. I said, we're going out to dinner with Brussels, great restaurants. We went out to dinner, had plenty of wine. And I can say this now after all these years. I said, listen, all four of us, blood brothers right here, nobody says a word. We're blood brothers because Tom was his name, the engineer. We throw Tommy under the bus. He's through. Yeah. Was it a bad mistake? It was a bad mistake.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's not anybody around that couldn't make that in the heat of battle. Plus, he's brand new on the airplane. So I swear to God, I thought Tommy was going to kiss me on the lips. He was so happy.
Well, you know,
so we come out looking pretty good, you know, so.
That's the thing. There are those who made those mistakes, those that will. The fact that you're all walking and you're enjoying wine and living to talk about it.
No question.
You can chalk it up and It's something I'm sure he never did again.
There is no doubt in my mind. You know, I could probably look him up, but I've never talked to him since. When we get back to Newark, you know, they put a new engine on it. And we get back to Newark, I never saw him again. In fact, I don't think I saw any of the crew members, but if they would happen to be listening to this, they know exactly.
That's funny.
The feelings and everything else. But it is a interesting story. I think I've lost three engines in my career. Every one of them was on the 777. I mean, the 747. Well, one of them was on the 7-2.
Okay, well, that's better than most of the planes. You know, if you do that in the Viper, it's going to be different. It's good to have, options.
I come off the target in Desert Storm in the Viper with that Pratt engine, got a little bit slow looking over my shoulder to see where my bombs hit, and kawoom, the goddamn compressor stalled because I got slow.
Yeah.
You could take that GE engine, as you well know, stick it straight up and slide backward, throw it in the burner, no issue.
And I've heard guys, there was actually a GE motor out of Korea. They installed some part backwards. That motor ran for like 40 hours and then it completely blew up. But for the fact, like if you think about the amount of stress that is going on in those fan and those turbine sections, installing any part backwards that it ran, that it even started, is amazing. But the fact that it ran for 40 hours before its catastrophic destruction is pretty impressive in my book.
Very much so.
Well, Slough, I really appreciate you taking the time today. An amazing career in aviation with a lot of great stories. And everyone's going to like listen to this. So again, thank you for taking the time. And it was great just being able to catch up and learn a little bit from you.
Rain, thanks so much for letting me tell my story. And I wish you all the best. You're doing some very good work for young people that are interested in an aviation career. And, you know, all the best to you.
I appreciate it.
Before you say it, don't bring it weak.
Yeah, don't bring it weak. I appreciate it. Thanks, love.
Hey, thanks for listening today. Again, swing over to iTunes, leave that rating and review, help the podcast grow. If you want to support the podcast and you're looking for more content and looking for some free merchandise that's included with your tiers, patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast, early episodes, ad-free, There I Was stories, and more bonus content. Again, patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.